The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk. Coming up in this week's podcast, Confessions of a Frustrated Journalist. We'll hear from our correspondent in China about the media crackdown following a fortnight of bloodshed in Tibet. Also in the show...
These days, with rolling news, blogging, all the stuff that we know, the news in many ways has become fiction. It's instantly fictionalised as soon as an event happens.
Writer Gordon Byrne describes why the headlines of 2007 provided the backdrop for his latest novel. Plus, we go behind enemy lines and hear about the latest strand of guerrilla journalism on current TV. And he's back.
You haven't got a bloody clue. Not a bloody clue. You're fired.
We deliver the verdict on Sir Alan and the new series of The Apprentice. All these stories and more coming up on Media Talk from The Guardian. To paraphrase a pinstriped public school twonk desperate to work for Amstrad, in life there are two types of people, winners and, well, Media Talk panellists. Welcome to Robert Freeman, The Guardian's head of video. How are you?
I'm well, yes.
And welcome back, Stephen Brook, press correspondent for MediaGuardian.co.uk. Who's the Nick and Margaret of this relationship, I want to know?
Who's Nick and who's Margaret?
You obviously don't watch The Apprentice.
Kind of interchangeable, aren't they? Because they've still got the same grey hairdos. They're the silent eyes and ears of Sir Alan when he goes on location.
Yeah.
I went to a party with last year's winner. I bumped into him at a club in Carnaby Street.
Marvellous. Enough about your nightlife. Thank you very much. Anyway, more talk about The Apprentice later. But right now, let's start with a bit of news.
I don't think there is a so-called widespread condemnation. I mean, those people could not represent the majority of the entire people in the world. What we hear from other governments is the support for the Chinese government to stabilize the situations there.
That's Liu Weimin from the Chinese embassy in London speaking on the BBC and putting his spin on the continuing protests about the violence in Tibet. Earlier this week in Greece, the Olympic torch ceremony was interrupted by further demonstrations beamed across the world. While back in China, Tibetan prisoners were paraded on state TV. Jonathan Watts is The Guardian's South Asia correspondent. He's in Beijing now, and he says the trouble in Tibet has led to the Chinese government going back on its promise to open up the country to the international media.
A year and a half ago, actually on the 1st of January in 2007, the government introduced new regulations that gave us foreign correspondents a lot more freedom of movement than we'd had until then. And under those new rules, theoretically, we are allowed to interview whoever we want, wherever we want, as long as we have the permission of the person we're speaking to. However, now that a semi-emergency situation has arisen in Tibet and Tibetan communities surrounding Tibet, those rules seem to have been totally bypassed. At least 40 journalists have been told they're not allowed to go where they want to go, even if the people in those areas are willing to be interviewed. So it's a big step backwards what's happened in the last couple of weeks.
And in the past few weeks, you've tried to travel around China, haven't you, particularly up towards the western provinces. And what was your experience?
I travelled extensively to try to visit one of the places that were reportedly seeing disturbances. I travelled to Qinghai, Sichuan and Gansu provinces, more than 10,000 kilometres overall in the space of about 8 days. But during that time, I was only able to get within a couple of hundred kilometres of where I actually wanted to go, because everywhere the police were blocking the way, saying we weren't allowed in, whether for our own safety or because of, they said, traffic problems or whatever was the excuse. The result was I was blocked and I wasn't able to go where I wanted to go.
This week, the authorities have organised a visit to Lhasa for selected journalists. Are there, and also they've opened up the internet again. They had been blocking sites from the West, such as the BBC and The Guardian, indeed. That seems to have been unblocked now. Are there signs that they are opening things back up again?
We are seeing constantly steps forward and steps backward. That has been the trend for the whole of the nearly 5 years that I've been in China. As soon as something looks to be going outside of the government's control, there's a big clampdown, and that's certainly what seems to be the case in Tibet. And then when they're feeling more comfortable, you do see relaxations and, as you say, the internet... certain sites get closed down, including The Guardian, then they get opened up. But overall, the trend, according to most of the Chinese journalists I speak to here, the overall trend is towards more opening. If we look back 10 years, for certain, everybody says things are much, much better than they are then. How much of a setback this month's problems in Tibet proves, it remains to be seen. There was a trip of foreign journalists allowed to go to Lhasa. They're there as we speak. That was just 26 of them. It's tightly controlled. They were only allowed to be in Lhasa for one day. But it was arranged at fairly short notice, which is encouraging. However, I heard today that there was actually a protest while they were in Lhasa, and 30 monks came up and said, "You're being told lies. Don't believe what the government is telling you." Whether that will be another setback and the government just can't bear to lose face again remains to be seen. There are people in the government who do want things to become more open. There are people in the government who want completely the opposite. They're tussling all the time, and the outcome is far from certain at the moment.
And it'll be interesting to see how that balance swings over the next few weeks and months in the run-up to the Olympics. I guess it might depend very much on how things go in Tibet, won't it?
I think it's going to depend on how things go in Tibet. It's going to depend on what kind of protests occur from now on. And let's not forget, Tibet is far from the only issue of concern to human rights groups and others who would like to embarrass the Chinese government, who would like to put their cases forward in a fairly provocative way. I think we will see more things happening, maybe with the Falun Gong groups, perhaps with free speech campaigns such as Reporters Without Borders that interrupted the lighting of the Olympic torch ceremony in Athens this week as well. So we will see more things happening. And I think this will be an absolute testing time for China's willingness to open up or not. The signs so far are not encouraging. The protests have probably been worse than the Chinese government anticipated. And the response is certainly that now the media environment of the last month is much, much tighter than it was a year ago.
And the big test, of course, will be during the actual event, the Olympics itself, because hundreds and hundreds of journalists, thousands even, I guess, are going to descend on Beijing from all over the world. Many of them will be expecting to be able to say and do what they want. They'll want to broadcast from wherever they want. And that's going to be a big test logistically, isn't it?
It's going to be the ultimate test, I think. The Chinese government is expecting 21,500 journalists who are accredited with the International Olympic Committee, plus 5,000 to 10,000 who are not accredited. So there's going to be a total deluge. At the moment, there's something like 600 resident foreign correspondents. And as we've seen in recent weeks, sometimes the government even struggles to find a way to deal with us. When there's this huge, huge wave of foreign journalists, I think they're really going to be struggling. What they're hoping is that most of those correspondents will be sports correspondents. They'll be totally focused on the events. They'll be mostly operating inside the stadiums. And I guess they hope they won't be going into the provinces to look at problems of things like Tibet, of land disputes, of AIDS cases, of industrial disputes, all of these sort of the dark side of China that the government would rather not come out. I think they're going to be sorely tested, and they're going to be experiencing a media challenge like nothing they've ever seen before.
It's interesting, Robert, isn't it, that the Chinese authorities have been blocking websites, blocking the BBC, blocking The Guardian, and then unblocking them again. It seems that they're finding it very tricky to find a balance between their stated aims to allow internet and journalistic freedom and really being rather uncomfortable about the world knowing what's going on in Tibet.
Well, in the first few days, you had a complete news blackout from Tibet, of course, apart from the Western media. We were getting our stories out, but they weren't then being reflected back in China. Then, after about 3 or 4 days, the Chinese began actually what was a very good and I think quite successful internal spin campaign, which basically ignored any aspects of there being peaceful protests or demonstrations and really just showed an awful lot of pictures, of which they had a great deal, of people in Tibet looting and setting fires and generally going on the rampage. So that's really the only view of these Tibetan incidents that has been seen in China.
And as Jonathan Watts was saying, Stephen Brooke, the big test is going to be when the Olympics actually happens themselves, and they're going to be these tens of thousands of foreign journalists, of international journalists descending on Beijing, many of whom will expect to be able to go wherever they want.
Well, I actually disagree. I think the real test is happening here and now, because we have seen the torch relay has started. What happened? They lit the torch in Greece in this Greek goddess ceremony, apparently, which was invented by the Nazis for the 1936 Olympics. Right. Anyway, and what happened? There was a Tibet protest. The state broadcaster in Greece censored the pictures.
They cut away from the protest.
Yeah, I believe they were under instructions to do so should something happen.
I mean, that's incredible. I mean, that's absurd. If the BBC had done that, there would be an outcry.
Exactly.
So here we have a group of Western broadcasters who are desperate to show the Olympics, which is a worldwide ratings winner, and they're prepared to stamp out footage of these protests, which are going to happen up and down people's local high streets when the torch passes through London. It's going to a lot of major centres. I think it's going to be fascinating just to see just how compliant the local broadcasters are, not just with the Chinese authorities, but the IOC, the Olympic Organising Committee, because it seems that they're very keen to try and get this political situation as far away from the Olympics as possible.
OK, you can follow this story on our news pages and the media site as well at guardian.co.uk. I'm Matt Wells. You're listening to Media Talk. Still to come, with audience ratings up 70%, we'll analyse the Kaplinsky effect on Five's early evening news. Plus,
if we can get people who might not necessarily be interested in this material, who might be more entertainment or pop cultural junkies, and say, hey, what's going on here? I want to know more. And I think that we can be doing a better benefit to that audience.
We discuss Vanguard reporting with Current TV's Laura Ling. First, though, cast your mind back to the summer of 2007. Headlines of floods, foot and mouth, disappearance of Madeleine McCann, not to mention terror attacks in Glasgow, and a change of Prime Minister. Well, the novelist Gordon Byrne has chosen that rich news period as the backdrop to his latest novel, Born Yesterday. It tells the tale about the way news is made and how the media creates, manipulates, and in many cases fictionalises those stories. The Guardian's Esther Adley went to meet him in Rome.
Having prepared for it for so long, Blair's handing over to Brown, I think we all thought we knew, you know, it would be a fairly straightforward thing. But I think the combination of Madeleine missing, Blair in a strange way going missing, even though it was we all had been prepared for it, and Brown coming in combined with the terrorist attacks, the flooding, and also his very strange personality after Blair, having a prime minister who, you know, never stop smiling, replaced by a prime minister who finds it very difficult to smile, and the strange vibe that came from that, the change in climate in the country when the changeover happened was so pronounced. I think people felt kind of strangely unnerved, and also we'd all been thinking for 2 months about Madeleine McCann at that point. And the book tries to make concrete that sense of unease that seemed to be flowing, you know, flushing around the country in 2007.
Can you give us a little more sense of what actually happens in the book?
The book, in a way, is told through the consciousness of somebody who's awash in current events and the news, in a way. In other words, the narrator is somebody who, like us all, takes a daily bath in news and media. And also, strangely, because of how he lives and where he lives in London, comes across public faces in private places, in a way, like Kate Middleton in a supermarket, like Tony Blair out of office. So the narrator experiences the news the way we all do, really, and self-edits it and forms it into a narrative that satisfies him.
You've obviously been a what you might call a crime reporter in the past. You've written two very well-received books, one about the Yorkshire Ripper and one in sort of forensic detail about Fred and Rosemary West. And it's something that you've written about repeatedly in your novels as well. Fuller Love, the main character, is a tabloid reporter. Is this novel in some way a comment on the business of reporting the news and how that may or may not have changed?
I think it is. I think even in the 10 years since Full of Love was published, I think the whole news gathering, news dissemination process has changed incredibly. I mean, who 10 years ago would have ever believed in how far the internet has spread, how much blogging is being done, how it's a rash, basically, it's a kind of a virus that's only really happened in about the last 5 or 6 years.
When you mention it as a rash, do you feel that the quality has diminished? Do you feel that there's a sort of moral comment to be made about the news and the business of reporting on people who are in the news?
I guess you wanted to be po-faced. You could say there's been a dilution, a diminution in the quality of news. But in some ways, it's a new reality, and I think it's actually quite exciting. I think it's quite it's a really hard time to be a novelist, because everybody, in some ways, are makers of fiction. So it's a hard time to be a fiction writer, but I think it's a really good time to be a fiction writer, because there's so much you have to compete with, which forces you to hopefully be slightly more either subversive or inventive, or makes you come up with new ways of capturing reality and presenting reality.
Well, I hope he's more exciting on the page than he is in that little extract.
Do you know
extract,
what? I completely
Matt.
Misheard you at the start, because I thought we were about to hear an interview by Gordon Burns, the presenter of the BBC's Northwest Tonight.
I was thinking,
he's very busy if he's got time to do the news and write books.
From Rome, yeah.
Well, I was going to make a Krypton Factor joke there, but you're both of you far too young for that. Anyway, Born Yesterday, the news as a novel, is published by Faber, and it's out next week.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on Guardian.co.uk.
There's still plenty to come in this week's podcast, but let's pause for a moment and reacquaint ourselves with some of the other media stories making the headlines over the past 7 days with Good Week, Bad Week.
It's been a good week for Channel 5, who've hailed the Natasha effect on its early evening news bulletin. The programme's seen its ratings grow by 72% since Miss Kaplinsky took on presenting duties a month ago. The BBC's head of news, Helen Bowden's, denied reports that Hugh Edwards is to spend 2 weeks in a sunbed and slip on a pair of figure-hugging Versace jeans, but he is definitely working on his pout. Sticking with the BBC, their head of sport, Roger Mosey, is continuing to trumpet the corporation's latest acquisitions. Just days after striking a deal with Bernie Eccleston for the Formula One season, this week the Beeb announced it secured the rights to Wimbledon until 2014. No official figures have been released about the deal, but it's safe to assume it'll cost you several million if you're English, or around 3 punnets of strawberries. Oh, and go on, you can have a Sue Barker too. Pod, should we make it a hat-trick of Beeb stories?
Why not? On you go, Robert.
Fantastic. It's terrible news for lovers of comedy. After the BBC said it'll commission another 2 series of the mysteriously popular My Family, the show will now stay on air until at least 2009, which will have given the writers almost 9 years to come up with at least one decent gag.
Well, you've had a couple of minutes, Robin. You're doing quite well so far.
And finally, move over Carla Bruni. Tony Blair's wife, Cherie Booth, is to take a leading role in Channel 4's forthcoming season about street crime. The barrister and part-time judge will head up a street weapons commission on behalf of the broadcaster, but Channel 4 say there are currently no plans to use Cherie instead of Kirsty Allsop or Sarah Beeny in any of its property shows. Ouch.
Thank you very much, Robert. Marvellously done as ever. Let's go quickly back to a few of those topics. Stephen, are you a Kaplinsky man?
I am, actually. I know that there's a lot of white noise that buzzes around Natasha, but when you get down to it at the end of the day, she's a very good news presenter. And watching her on the news presenting a solo bulletin rather than the sort of tag team that the BBC used to have for the 6 o'clock news, I think she does a very good job. And, Five's news ratings were very small before she took over.
I was going to say, 72% increase.
Not very much.
Is not very much, but, that they would feel, I guess, it more than justifies her £1 million salary.
You mentioned Carla Bruni only in passing, but I tell you, she's played the media very well.
She hasn't played anything. She's done nothing. She's just turned up, and it's wall-to-wall coverage. Everyone from Hello to The Guardian has been obsessed.
Well, it was her choice of Jackie Onassis outfits. That's what it was, Rob. I think that she didn't not do anything. She turned up and looked fabulous.
But the camera loves her, and a lot of commentators, certainly I was reading Simon Hoggart in The Guardian, and he's clearly captivated.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
The old adage that politics is celebrity for ugly people, and suddenly someone associated with politics is a bit of a knockout.
Yeah.
And all these middle-aged to elderly male columnists are falling over
themselves. And the MPs as well. They were drooling over Sarkozy in Parliament. It's just astonishing. Now, listen, that's a complete non-story, obviously. A real story is the news of things that are happening at the Daily Express. We were talking about this last time, Stephen, and now there have been some more developments, haven't there?
Yes, the journalists are going on strike. 3 rolling strikes they're starting next week because of a pay dispute. But at the chapel meeting, the members of the National Union of Journalists, when they voted, were highly critical of proprietor Richard Desmond, and they said that this, you know, unprecedented front-page apology on the four titles, The Daily and Sunday Express and The Daily Star and The Daily Star Sunday, because of this string of ridiculous made-up stories about the McCann family, actually had its roots in Desmond's editorial interference.
They're blaming him.
Yes, they're saying that he has driven this obsessive coverage because I think he saw the circulation benefits in doing so, and he realised that this was a story that...
But were there actually any circulation benefits?
Well, this is the thing. I'm not convinced there were. I mean, there clearly are online, aren't there, Robert? I mean, the Madeleine McCann stories are constantly... If you look at those most read stories on any news website, you know, if there's a McCann story around that day, it's always
exactly.
It's always
there. You can look at Google Zeitgeist or any kind of ratings engine, and McCann stories... play highly.
So they're not therefore, always at the top, answer but they that question, highly. Yes.
Sorry, don't all speak over each other. Say again, right?
So then we've answered the question, yes, in affirmative.
Well yes, in a way, but the sales of the Express haven't gone up. So the question is, would they have fallen a bit faster, I
Well,
suppose.
In a declining market, I think that they were more than happy with the circulation performance of the papers.
The other story that we must mention before we move on is Dr. Tanya Byron. Is it House of Tiny Tearaways? Is that the show that she does?
Or Little Angels.
I can't remember.
This is the one with the naughty step.
That's Super Nanny.
Anyway, she's one of those people. She's a TV psychologist. Actually, she's a very intelligent person and has come out with a very intelligent report about violence on the internet and how it affects children. Rob, what she's saying is that there have to be more controls over what children watch and a more clear idea for parents about what the various labels mean. Do you think that's a good idea?
Absolutely. I think the quote I heard from her this week was the fact that leaving your children to play alone in their room with a computer was like leaving them out in the street unsupervised. And I absolutely agree. But the problem is that parents, for a very long time, have got used to sitting a kid in front of the idiot box where you've got, you know, a nanny broadcaster like the BBC, who actually, you know, if I had children, I would quite happily sit them in front of the BBC and not have to worry. The problem is that after 25, 30 years of that generational assumption, I think parents are trying to do the same thing with the computer, and it's absolutely not the same.
Well, there's absolutely nothing wrong with our Tech Weekly podcast. This is our case for the defence.
On this week's Tech Weekly, we're speaking with author and internet pundit Clay Shirky about the social and economic implications of the web. We're also delving into the past to learn about the future. The first of our retro features is on the implications of the BBC Micro on today's British technology industry. It's a packed show because we're also bringing you the latest news and opening up our brand new VoIP hotline via Skype. You can subscribe, or Tech Weekly is available to download every Tuesday from guardian.co.uk/audio.
Media Talk.
Tucked away on channel 193 on Sky, or 155 on Virgin, is a channel called Current. It received a whole load of publicity when it launched in America in 2005 as the world's first peer-to-peer information network, at least that's how they described it, and not just because Al Gore is one of its founders, but probably mostly because Al Gore is one of its founders. Current's schedule is made up of short pods, rather than traditional half-hour programmes or so, with a more immediate and visual journalistic grammar. It's quite different from what we're used to on mainstream television. The subject matter is also a bit more radical. Current's journalists are armed with little more than a DV camera and probably a shot of Dutch courage too, if the coverage is anything to go by. Their new weekly Vanguard reports feature short films about China's booming sex industry, marijuana cultivation in California's national forests, and the US government's use of waterboarding. We went to the launch of the season to find out more.
So I'm on the road on the way to Tora Bora. We got six armed guards, and they got Czechoslovakian made AK-47s.
The UN is fired upon by people in these areas, by gangs in this area.
Laura Lang, Vice President of the Vanguard Department at Current TV. Current is a 24-hour news and information network for young adults. We broadcast in the United States and in the UK.
Migrants call it the train of death, and this is how they travel all the way to the U.S. border.
The train keeps on jerking, so you have to keep a constant grip.
Vanguard is Current's
journalism, original journalism franchise. Viewers can see reports ranging from the rise of neo-Nazism in Russia to the oil industry and oil crisis situation going on in Nigeria. We're trying to offer a very global perspective about what's going on in the world for our audience of young adults.
So Fatah soldiers are firing and Hamas supporters start throwing stones at us. We're going to back up here.
The idea is to be out in front of events in terms of journalism. It's to try to go beyond the standard news headlines to offer a bigger picture about what's going on in the world. Our journalists are... the approach is very personal, sometimes a little bit more in your face, and a little bit more rough around the edges. And part of that is because we usually will just, you know, go into a place with one or two people carrying small digital video cameras, and that allows for a lot more access and intimacy.
If you want to have an abortion in Mississippi, you have to come here to the last abortion clinic left. And this is what you have to go through.
Daughter, can I talk to you like a mother in the Lord? Come here, sweetheart.
If it's a big investigation, some of those pieces can take up to a year to set up to get access. And that's why we're working on several stories at once. Some stories, on the other hand, we shoot in a week, and it's on air in a half-hour special, you know, 2 or 3 weeks later. So multiple correspondents and producers are working on multiple stories at any given time. Check that out. This is possibly the largest industrial size marijuana crop in the entire world, right here. We go through a very rigorous internal risk assessment. Every single story that we do, we put through a risk assessment process and have rejected stories that haven't met certain criteria. But at the same time, we are in the business of journalism and trying to tell stories that haven't been told and that are important for our audience. For example, when we sent a team into Somalia, we didn't send a team there to report on the fact that Somalia is a poor, violent place. That's not a new story. Everyone knows that this country has been mired in conflict and is stricken with poverty. We went there during the time when the Islamic Court Union, a group, had taken control of Mogadishu, and actually there was a sense that they had brought a sense of stability to that region, and some change was in the air. Who knew what was going to happen at this point? Were these Islamic terrorists, or were they bringing a sense of stability to people that, you know, they hadn't seen? Was it a little bit of both? What was going on here? It was necessary to take the risk because that story wasn't being told. And having decided that, we took all, you know, necessary precautionary measures where we felt comfortable to send our guys into the field.
The scene, in short, is a bunch of dudes with guns who stopped us and are checking us out. Hey, I don't know if you can see this out your right window, right? But that truck with the tarp on it is actually a giant Technical. And it's got a huge machine gun pointed right at our car.
Laura Ling from Current there, and the music you heard is actually from their promo material, not the actual documentaries. Robert, you're a Current viewer, are you?
I am, yeah. I'm actually quite a fan of Current.
What makes it distinctive?
A part of it is that the fact that they have enormous reach and access to stories because they've got a great model. They basically solicit anyone with a DV camera who can do short filmmaking to create something. You create your own story, you annotate it with metadata, you upload it to the website, and it is then viewed and voted on by the community. Anyone who's watching Current on the web worldwide. The best of that stuff gets voted to the top. It's a bit like Dig or Reddit, those same sort of voting engines. And then the stuff that rises to the top gets played out on television. And it gives them an absolutely enormous pool of filmmaking and Current pay. It's an extortionately expensive model, particularly when you're going to places like Mogadishu. I'm not sure I would send any of our teams there in a hurry, but for those that dare and for those that are well equipped for this kind of thing, you do get some amazing exclusive material, and they pay for it as well.
And so do the people who go out and film the stories, do they don't, from what you're saying, doesn't sound like they work for Current.
They have an in-house team,
right.
But then they also solicit pretty much stories from the whole of the rest of the world. And what that does mean that you get is loads of young, bright, intelligent filmmakers with interesting stories to tell. I wouldn't say, I mean,
you'd also get loads of crap, though, surely.
That's true, but then that's, you don't get the crap on the television, because the crap is what stays on the website, and actually very few people look at it because it gets voted down.
It sounds a bit student newspaperish, but quite good, until she declaimed that she was the venue for intimate, in-your-face Current Affairs, which has surely got to be a worry.
Well, it does have a certain style, because it's all about the short attention span.
Edgy for low budget, because that's what we're really talking about.
Basically, if you can make enough cuts in a 60-second period, you can keep people watching.
Vanguard is on Sunday nights at 9 o'clock, and it's not on a porn channel, it's on Current.
It's quite close to the porn channels there. What was it, 9-0 something?
I think it is. Well, interestingly, it's not in the documentary slot. It's in the entertainment section on Sky.
Surely some right-wing conspiracy there.
I think not. uk.current.com for more details. From journalism on the front line to punditry in the front room, we'll finish off this week. We haven't got Gareth McLean this week, but it doesn't seem to matter because we've got you two. So now,
Gareth, I so hope you heard that.
yeah, Gareth, don't bother coming back next week.
He's in Leeds. I don't know what he's doing in Leeds, actually. It's Yorkshire Television there, so he'll be up on a maybe visit.
Hollyoaks, I'm thinking, maybe.
That's Liverpool, isn't it?
Emmerdale. Yeah. I bet he's Emmerdale. Yeah. Who watched The Apprentice?
I've got it on my TiVo, so I won't probably see it. I won't catch up
for
a couple of weeks.
Well, I'll spoil it all for you right now. I was in a very funny mood last night because I thought, The Apprentice, which I do like a lot. I totally wasn't in the mood, though, but from the opening lusciously shot views of the London skyline, I was once again hooked.
I know. I didn't want to be. I thought, I can't go through this for another 16 weeks again, however many
but
it is.
But you're going to, aren't you? Because Sir Alan is just a TV genius.
Very white and very public school.
Well, fascinatingly now is that for the first time I think I can remember for a while, the boys are far more interesting.
Far more attractive
than the girls.
Don't mind me saying so.
Well, it is your show. But no, what we've got is this fantastic class struggle now, because you've got those sort of wide boys who are sort of East End or Northern against the posh public school.
It was a very crude class ending, wasn't there? Which was, it was the posh one that got fired because he criticised the working class Northern guy, or the guy who
lacked education.
Yeah. But he, in fact,
which is just such a fool to go to Sir Alan of all people with that argument, wouldn't
you? Yeah, absolutely. No, it didn't work. Now, Sam Wollaston, the guy. TV critic got an almighty flack on the website for daring to criticise the number one ladies' detective agency. He was called gutless, predictable, and tossy. And one commenter even said, "Where's Nancy Banks Smith when the world is clamouring for her?" And there was another one said that Sam Wollaston was the prime example of the Guardian's sneering tendency.
Well, I imagine that the number one ladies' detective agency would have annoyed a lot of Guardianistas as being just too sort of
sweet and saccharine.
But it's Easter Sunday.
Exactly.
You want something like that sometimes. Sometimes I just want to sit down and not be offended and just finish something and just feel uplifted and just pleased with myself and the world.
Yes, well, it was that sort of thing. Mind you, on the other side, they had He Kills Coppers, which is this gritty detective, 50s, 60s detective drama thing on ITV, which is a brilliant piece and I absolutely what ITV should be doing rather than all the dreadful toss they've been doing recently, but they put it on.
They put it on
Easter Sunday when, as Rob says, you don't want that gritty realism. You want something a bit more, soft and saccharine. What are you going to say, Rob?
Well, the scheduling for that was a problem. Also, the promotion of it. I saw a couple of not very well done television ads for He Kills Coppers. I think with ITV's drama, there are some really good elements to it, which I would nominate. Sharp intake of breath here. Heartbeat. And the bill, because...
The bill,
I will defend the bill, because lately it has been fantastic, and it just won the RTS award.
He is Australian, of course.
Thank you very much for continuing drama. The episode this week about the child pedophile internet network was harrowing and very powerful, and as we've discussed earlier in the podcast, extremely topical.
Okay.
So I want to know, given the news this week that we've got I think it's the province of Alberta in Canada, soliciting for British coppers to come and work in Canada, whether you're going to see the Bill Canada or the Bill Alberta.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
but they're all very polite. Well, you know, you arrest someone and he calls you sir.
Absolutely. In Calgary, where it was Calgary in Alberta, where the criminals actually come up and, you know,
give themselves up.
It's a fair cop, cuff. Yeah, well, they probably don't say that, do they? Listen, we'll leave all that there if you don't mind. Thank you very much, Rob Freeman and Stephen Brook, for wisdom beyond your years, says here. If you want to comment on any of the topics we've discussed, head to our blog on Organ Grinder or post a comment on our Facebook wall. And it's controversial, I know, but may I also please point you in the direction of a program made by our rivals at the BBC, Rather Good Five Live podcast, called For the Love of Pod, a program all about podcasting. You can download it from the BBC website. There's rather a nice bit with me in it too.
I was going to say, I was waiting for
that's
that.
That's the reason, right. The method to your madness.
By the by. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. I'm Matt Wells. See you next time. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.